Welcome to The Week in 60 Minutes, brought to you by Spectator TV, recorded on Thursday, February the 18th. On this week's show, will we still be in lockdown come summer? The chances are the rules will be eased, but by how much? And would vaccine passports mean greater freedom? The Spectator's political team will tell us about next week's exit strategy announcement from the Prime Minister. We'll be joined by Trevor Phillips and Rod Little to discuss vaccine passports. We'll take a look at the global vaccine game China and Russia are now using to export their vaccines as soft power to gain favor in developing countries. How can the West respond? And finally, how TV and film have given us a renewed interest in England's Anglo-Saxon origins. All that to come in the next hour. As always, if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel, and why wouldn't you? It's free. You'll never miss a program. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. A very special thanks to Charles Stanley for their continued support of The Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange, and we're delighted to have them as our partners at Spectator TV. Now, on Monday, Boris Johnson will set out how he sees England leaving its third lockdown. So what can we expect to hear? I'm joined by James Forsyth, the Spectator's political editor, and Katie Balls, our deputy political editor. James, first of all, before we look at what he might say, what are the forces crowding in on him? Is it, on the one hand, scientific advice, don't be too hasty, and Tory backbenchers on the other saying, rid us of this lockdown?
I think that is broadly right, Andrew. I think that the scientists are essentially arguing for the first time in this crisis, you're ahead of the curve on the virus. So let's go very slowly. Let's try and drive COVID right down. The lower the number of cases, the more likely you are, the less likely you are to get a kind of mutation that could evade the vaccines and send you back to square one. On the other hand, you have Tory MPs arguing businesses are running out of money. If they can't reopen, the economic damage is going to be worse. And what was the point of the vaccine program if it wasn't to return to normal? And they're making the case that, you know, the political benefit comes from being able to open up before other countries because of the success of the vaccine program.
Katie, how much pressure is there from the Tory backbenches? I think you and I have talked before about before this wave that hit us again before Christmas, there had been quite a lot in the late summer, early autumn, a lot of Tory pressure on the Prime Minister to ease up the then lockdown, and he did some of that. Is it true to say that this latest wave of the pandemic has been so virulent that that kind of lockdown pressure isn't as strong, or removal of lockdown pressure is not as strong as it was?
I think that is fair to say. It is not as strong as it has been previously, but it is starting to bubble to the surface again. And I think that right now, everyone is waiting for this roadmap. So the only group really willing to go public is the COVID recovery group, Steve Baker, Mark Harper, in a way, the usual suspects. And we've heard from them this week talking about concerns that the government is shifting strategy by focusing on case numbers rather than just whether or not the NHS is overwhelmed in terms of how to ease the lockdown. However, I get the impression that this group are not going to be lonely for too long. And if you do have a situation where Boris Johnson in this roadmap suggests, and we don't know for sure how far they'll go on dates, but suggests that, you know, hospitality won't be open till July, August, in a way that would resemble something close to normal, I think you'll start to get a wider Tory backlash. And ultimately, if you look at that third lockdown, where there was a smaller rebellion than previous ones, it was down to a few factors that you pointed to. So the fact you had the new variant spreading so fast, this worry about the high death toll that would lead to. I think that now you have vaccines, a lot of those factors in the views of the bulk, the mainstream Tory MPs, are going to go away. They're going to fall away. And I think when it comes to talking about if all the over 50s have been vaccinated, they have some protection. I think at that point, many Tory MPs, not just the COVID recovery group, think this is a different illness. So if Boris Johnson is listening more to scientific advisers who are not quite calling for zero COVID, but are calling for this, tightly controlled cases, even once the vulnerable are vaccinated, I think that is going to get quite strong opposition in the Tory party, even if we've just had a difficult situation in hospital.
James, before we come on to what the Prime Minister might say, just frame some of the considerations. Obviously, vaccine policy is clearing the way for some kind of relaxation. We don't know how much. But I see, again, a new emphasis, too, on testing. Lots of rapid reaction testing, that 65% of the population may be regularly tested now with these rapid tests. So the testing is now becoming another sort of arm in the government's response along with the vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, I think the government's theory is that testing essentially allows you to reopen before everyone has been vaccinated. So you encourage people to test regularly if they're going back into their workplace or back into school. And that should basically hopefully keep the kind of most infectious people at home rather than out spreading the virus. And that should ease the pressure on the NHS until the vaccination programme has finished. I think we are heading to a broader philosophical debate, though, about how we handle viruses in general in this country. I think that lots of Tory MPs at the end of this, once everyone has been vaccinated, they just want to go back to normal. I think there are people on the public health side who think that, you know, the British habit of going to work when they're sick is unhealthy and that needs to be stopped. And I think that, I think there'll be an interesting balancing act there. I also think we are going to end up almost inevitably with a kind of pandemic alert level, a bit akin to a terrorism alert level, that, we'll all wake up one morning and because of some worry about some new virus somewhere, it'll be back to wearing masks on public transport, that kind of thing. I don't think we're going to go back to the status quo ante. I think we are going to become a society that is more nervous about viruses going forward from this. In much the same way that you saw a shift in behaviour in places like Taiwan after SARS, I think you're going to see a similar change here.
So, James, what do we think the headlines will be next week? I mean, all the papers have been full of speculation. I've seen Downing Street warning other journalists off some of what's been printed. And for this government, Thursday, here we are in the middle of Thursday. Monday's a long time away. We know a lot can happen with this government in its reaction. But what do we think the headlines will be?
Well, I think one of the big questions is, the government had, under pressure from its MPs, promised this roadmap on the 22nd of February. But the data from the vaccination programme is only just coming in now. And so I think that is one of the big things. I think that what you will see from the government is, and it will try and do three things. It wants to carry on under-promising and over-delivering. So it doesn't want to set dates that it can't meet. But it also needs to give Tory MPs and businesses enough hope that that people keep going. I think there is definitely a worry among some cabinet ministers at the moment, but the government's tone is so downbeat that there is a real risk that businesses just throw in the towel. They say, well, look, I'm never going to get to reopen at full capacity for so long. I might as well shut up shop now rather than wait until I kind of run out of money. And because even with the support, businesses are running out of cash at the moment. So I mean, that is the question. I think the big thing is as well that the government wants to go to wait 2 weeks after each relaxation to see what happens. So I suspect on March the 8th, schools will go back, things like tennis and golf will be allowed outside. People will maybe be allowed to be grateful for small mercies, be allowed to sit down outside with somebody else and have a cup of coffee. And then I think, then they want to wait 2 weeks to see what effect that all has on the R number before you move to the next phase. I think the kind of question is essentially, how quickly do you get to go back inside a pub or a restaurant. And I suspect at the moment, the May Day bank holiday is when I would be beginning to think about that as lightly.
Katie, where does this leave the Labour Party now? I see Keir Starmer is doing a kind of big relaunch speech. We know the pandemic has caused the government huge problems. The vaccine has helped to restore its ratings a little bit. But a lot of us, I think, are surprised at how the pandemic has in some ways been even more difficult for Labour as an opposition than it has been for Johnson as a government.
Yes, we've had Keir Starmer giving a big speech today, briefed out as a moment, not quite a reset in the terms of Labour advisers working on that speech, but definitely after a difficult few weeks where Keir Starmer has received a lot of criticism for his leadership or lack of impact of his leadership. I think the speech was supposed to be a big moment, but once again, it is generating a few headlines, but it's not the top story. And I think that loads around Keir Starmer really do now believe that actually it's very hard to do opposition politics in a pandemic. Conversely, you could say surely it could be, when you have a government which has overseen a death toll over 100,000, something that the Labour leader could respond to quite effectively. But they have definitely taken the position that they are in a difficult spot and the public do not want to see two parties scrapping at a time of national crisis. So I think that when you speak to those around Keir Starmer, they really believe that when he'll start to make his impact is, you know, in a year or so. It's not so much they're writing this off completely, but they don't see it as that core period where he is making that impact. I think the question is how long do those around him tolerate that, because already there is quite a lot of frustration at the pace he is going at.
We were talking, Katie, in late autumn that if the Johnson government didn't get its act together, there could be a leadership crisis in the Tory party by spring. And the vaccine seems to have been his get out of jail card to avoid that. Isn't there the makings of a leadership crisis now in the Labour Party?
So I think it's an interesting one, because I think we're going to head to a period where Keir Starmer will come under a lot of scrutiny. There's already a lot of pressure on him to change his shadow cabinet. And I don't think it's a particularly enjoyable period for him and his team. And I think that's going to stay. However, when you speak to Labour MPs and those on the left and you pose this question of, well, will Keir Starmer make it to the next election? They often laugh at you because they say historically, you know, the Tory party often will do something rather brutal. They will find the way to respond and deal and get the person they think is most likely to win votes. But they say that is not the Labour way. And therefore, it's more likely Keir Starmer will have a painful time in the build to the next election than actually a crisis where people look to move him.
I'm quite surprised, James, the way Keir Starmer hasn't been able to make the times work in his favour, because there's one way of looking at it in which they are propitious. You know, the pandemic is probably the most serious challenge this country has faced since the Second World War. Victory in the Second World War demanded a huge scaling up of government doing all sorts of things it had never done before, and we won. And in 1945, Labour said, look what government did there. We need to continue with big government and build on that, and government can do more. And we got the Attlee government, which won by a landslide, even though Churchill had won the war. If you're on the left, you could argue exactly the same, surely, on the pandemic, that it's taken massive government spending and intervention to get on top of this pandemic. And we need more government post-pandemic to do all sorts of things that Labour governments should be doing. But he doesn't seem to frame it in that way.
Yeah, and you can add to that that the government appears to have discovered the magic money tree during this pandemic. You know, it has paid 80% of the wages of a huge percentage of the private sector workforce, and yet it is still borrowing at very cheap rates. I think the problem for Keir Starmer is the Corbyn years have left Labour convinced that they need to recover their reputation for, you know, fiscal responsibility. So they have been kind of reluctant to embrace this moment and how cheaply governments can borrow, because I think they worry that voters will just hear, you know, the same old Labour, that, you know, they always run out of somebody else's money if they start talking about borrowing huge sums. I think the other problem that you face is this is akin to the war ends in 45 And then Churchill has three years before he has to go to the electorate again. And, you know, in that three-year period, Churchill probably would have introduced the National Health Service. You know, how many of the issues would that have taken away that Labour fought the 45 election on? And I think one of the challenges for them is, you know, Tory economics is shifting quite dramatically during this crisis. Tory party attitudes towards industrial policy is shifting. Just look at the way in which, you know, people regard the vaccine and the links between Oxford and AstraZeneca and the government as an example of, you know, how you do industrial policy. So I think that's the other challenge for Labour. I think Starmer's big problem is that he's a cautious politician. And on becoming leader, he essentially took a bet that in the British system, oppositions don't win elections, governments lose them. And so he took this very cautious approach. And last autumn, as you were saying, when lots of things were going wrong for the government and Boris Johnson was coming under pressure, you know, Labour went ahead in the polls. And this seemed like a bet. He seemed to have detoxified the Labour Party post-Corbyn. And the government seemed to be making enough mistakes that denying the Tories a majority at the next election was looking a distinct possibility for them. The problem is that if you are waiting for the government to lose the election, when something goes right for the government, as the vaccine programme has gone right, you're left with very little to stand on. And I think that is the problem for him right now. You know, his whole strategy inherently depends on the government making mistakes. So when the government gets onto a better run, he is left quite exposed.
James, Katie, thanks for that. Always bringing us up to date on the latest in Westminster and what might be happening next week. Now, on next week, the government says it won't bring in official vaccine passports, but that's not stopping businesses and organisations from creating their own. What does this mean for those who don't want to get vaccinated? In particular, what does it mean for our ethnic communities, who we know are much more vaccine hesitant? I'm joined by Trevor Phillips, Times columnist, former chair of the Equalities Commission and itinerant writer for The Spectator, and Rod Liddell, a Spectator columnist. Welcome to you both. Rod, you wrote about vaccine passports this week. I still wasn't sure in the end if you were for or against them.
No, I'm not sure either, to be honest. What I was talking about...
I read that right then.
You got it right, Andrew. I was looking at what the government was trying to do and why they had moved away in the last couple of weeks from the idea of a mandatory vaccine passport. And it occurred to me that it was going to be in trouble simply through grounds of discrimination, that we would be in a position where large quantities of our British black ethnic minority people are reluctant to have the vaccine, and that would see them excluded from a whole manner of things, such as cinemas, such as possibly transport, such as restaurants, such as pubs, and so on. And I think the government thought it would be rather better if business took the brunt for that particular problem rather than themselves. That was my worry.
And you raised that about Alabama in the segregation South before the civil rights in the 60s. But I wonder if that's is that a fair comparison? I mean, if I'm the bus driver in Montgomery, Alabama, I don't let you onto my bus because you're black. There's nothing you can do about the color of your skin. If I'm a restaurant owner, I'm not letting you in, whatever your color, because you haven't got a vaccine passport. You can change that.
No, sure. Get one. Sure, Andrew. And I was being a little bit facetious, but nonetheless...
I got that bit too, Rod.
That's what you want me to say.
There are many in the black and ethnic minority community who would say that it amounts to pretty much the same thing and would argue strongly that the reason for lack of take-up, and I'm sure Trevor knows more about this than I do, that one of the reasons for the lack of take-up is because, and this has been quoted in the United States on vaccination programs before now, historic injustice at the hands of the health service for black and ethnic minority people. So in the end, the chap on the bus, it's effectively the same, if not quite as brutal.
Okay, Trevor, what do you make of this?
Well, I read Rod's piece, and one thing you can say about Rod's journalism is never knowingly undercooked. I think he's taking it to wild places. But there is a basic and an important point that he raises here. I think the answer, if you're asking specifically about the issue of what Rod describes as mandatory vaccine passports, well, there are two elements to that. Mandatory? No, I don't think so. I think that gets us into very difficult territory. How do you police it? How do you qualify it? All that stuff. But vaccine passports that demonstrate that you've had it in the same way as you do for yellow fever, if you're going to certain countries and so on, I don't see any problem with that at all. I think actually that would be to everybody's advantage. And today we can do that pretty simply by putting an app on your phone. So I'm completely up for that. And I don't really see that there's any necessary probability of discrimination in that. I think that there's a bigger problem behind this, which is that, if I can put it bluntly, neither the government or anybody else really knows what they're talking about on this. We're hearing a lot about, we know that there is vaccine reluctance. Well, what we've got is some opinion polls that tell us that, but we don't know that actually people from minorities are taking it up in less frequently than others. I've had my own vaccine, by the way, given to me by a Chinese nurse who really made me feel, she said to her mate, I don't check this guy because I don't think he's old enough to have it. So it made me feel rather good about it. And I suspect that's going on all around the health service.
So you had to pay
for
your
vaccine. I think that there's a lot of nonsense talk. If you look at the NHS data.
You paid the Chinese nurse for the vaccine, I can see.
Not at all. She was lovely. I think there's a lot of nonsense being talked. So, for example, it's routinely said that ethnic minorities are more likely to die. If you look at the ONS data, week by week from April last year, the split between white and non-white has been 86-14, 86%, 14%, absolutely steadily every single week. And as you will know, that is the split in the population as a whole. Now, it may be that some minority groups are dying at greater rate, but that's probably balanced by those who are less likely to die. It may also be that minorities are more likely to become infected, but because they have a younger age profile, less likely to die. The problem is we do not know. If I can point the finger at government, they have been absolutely scandalously lax in trying to understand the dynamics of this issue. And they have got many things absolutely wrong on this question.
I take issue with one thing that Trevor says there, which is the lack of data on black and ethnic minorities taking up the vaccine. There is quite a bit of data. It's sporadic. I quote a couple in the piece I was writing. One is from, I think, North Staffordshire, and I think this was largely Bangladeshi patients to GP surgeries were 10 times less likely to take up the vaccine than were their white neighbours. And there was a similar study, I think the government's own figures have also suggested that amongst African and British Caribbean people, the take-up is somewhere in the region of 50% as opposed to round about just over 80% for white people. So I think there is a difference there. But I think underneath that difference, I don't think it's as simple as I think socioeconomics come into it. In some cases, in some parts of the our Muslim community, I was talking to Mohammed Abbasi, the leader of the Association of British Muslims today, and the various Muslim groups have done an enormous amount to make sure that the Muslim community is taking up their vaccine. But there's still some worry in some parts, particularly amongst Bangladeshis, that the vaccine might have some contaminatory pig stuff in it, something like that. There's still that slight resistance there. So there's loads and loads of different reasons why, and I think most of them are socioeconomic, minority people may not be taking up the
vaccine. Let me go back to Trevor. Trevor. No, let's see if we can reestablish contact with Trevor and we'll get back to him. He does seem to have frozen. Rod, let me come back to you just for a second. So it seems that I think you and Trevor both agree that there shouldn't be mandatory sort of government-endorsed passports, vaccine passports. But what about the private sector? Putting aside your sort of Alabama analogy, I see Trevor's back with us. I'll come to him in a minute. Let me finish this question. I mean, for example, suppose we hope, it's maybe a long shot, we might this summer be able to do our famous Spectator summer party. Now, you know it well. It's usually in a steamy July night. People are crammed in a they're outdoors, but it's pretty crammed in. There's not much social distancing. If we were to say to people, you're welcome to come to our summer party, we're managing to do it this year, but you have to have a vaccine passport, what would be wrong with that?
I don't see that anything would be wrong with that. I'm with Trevor on that. The problem is how it's perceived. And there will be people who try to whip up the cause of discrimination. And they will say that it's simply discriminating. Firstly, in favour of the affluent, because we know as well, the affluent and the elderly are the two tranches of the population who are most likely to take up the vaccine. So that wouldn't particularly hurt the Spectator summer party, as it's comprised largely of the affluent and the elderly.
Oh, it's full of young folks. It's a multiracial event too.
Yes, you're quite right. But I think in the broader world, some people will find a problem with that.
Okay, let me go back to Trevor. I'm delighted we've established contact again. You wanted to reply there to Rod, particularly on the data. Let's come back to that and tell us what we know.
Let me say, I think that there is some thing going on, but the problem is we do not know. By the way, on the question you've just been discussing, the truth of the matter is, why are you going to pay any attention to any idiot who thinks that the possibility of discrimination is a bigger deal than the fact that black people might actually die from this thing? I mean, frankly, I don't think we need to be bothered with those people. Our problem, the problem that we've got at the moment is that there are lots of things we do not actually know to be true. We need the data for this reason, to understand what it is that is going wrong. I do not believe that, for example, the problem is language proficiency. Fewer than 2% of people in this country cannot read or understand English well enough to understand the messages that are coming forward. Nor do I think there is some craziness about what's going on in the internet. We can't one day be complaining about digital exclusion of minorities and then say they're not turning up because they're all busy on Twitter imbibing the conspiracy theories. That's all nonsense. I think there are probably two or three things we need to look at. First of all, historic mistrust of authority. I think Rod's got that right. Secondly, I think we need to look at where vaccination's taking place. In the United States, they've shown in Massachusetts that on average, vaccination centres, white people are twice as likely to live within a mile of a vaccination centre as black people. And that's part of the example. And the third thing, which nobody wants to talk about, but is a real thing, is that we need to think about people who may be undocumented and who are not coming forward because what they believe is any contact with the authorities of this kind will turn the eye of Sauron, the immigration authorities, on them, and that actually they may get a jab, but the next week they'll be out of the country. And that's the thing that we've got to try and deal with. Give those people confidence that the system isn't going to lead to them being targeted by immigration authorities.
I'm interested, though, Trevor, that you say that the figures are not as clear-cut as some of the coverage has been, that we need to be careful in talking about the uptake being that different from the rest of the population.
Well, the narrative has overcome any regard for data. And as you know, Andrew, my business is now data scientists, and I can't tell you how furious I mean, to take Rod's point, I understand why he believes that, but I can tell you for certain, we'll publish a paper on this probably in the next 3 or 4 weeks. There is one large local authority. We've run the records of about 1 million patients. And what we know is that there are about 500,000 records in that authority, which has a couple of million people in it, which have no ethnicity data on them. So the data on which the NHS is working, it has a huge margin of error. There's loads of things we do not know, but people are asserting confidently. And unfortunately, that will probably mean that we're probably making mistakes, taking the wrong steps and ignoring, for example, very small groups who need some special treatment.
That's fascinating. Rod, I'll give you a final word on this.
I think the fascinating thing is the take-up of the vaccine in Europe. It seems to me,
almost certain that one of the reasons for the very high take-up in the UK is the fact that it's a bit of patriotism in there. There's a bit of good news story that we were developing the vaccine and have done better than the rest of Europe in getting it out. And I think that's rather swung more people than were expected behind the vaccine. But it's also fascinating to look at the various reasons in Europe, particularly amongst countries which suffered under totalitarian governments, the Visegrad countries where take-up is very low, East Germany, where take-up is a lot lower than it is in West Germany. But Germany, again, as another example, they had a much-hated vaccination program from 1874, compulsory for smallpox, and it did wonders. It eradicated smallpox from Germany. But it was very unpopular, particularly under the Weimar government, because of the side effects and some children dying in schools as a consequence of this. It was all carried out in schools. So there's a long historical memory of compulsory vaccination and a big government bearing down upon people. And that's one reason why the take-up's so low. Another reason, I think, could be the obverse to what I was saying about Britain, that in Europe they have mishandled the vaccine appallingly. It has been slow, sluggish under the EU, and I suspect that that has its effect upon what people think about the vaccine in the end. It's a fascinating topic.
I think Rod's got a really important point there. We talk about minorities and we constantly are thinking about people of colour. Let's bear in mind we have at least nearly a million people from Poland in this country, plus from other East European countries, many of whom have parents and grandparents who lived under authoritarian regimes who, frankly, could not be trusted. And it's not surprising if some of that, if you like, memory would discourage them from trusting any authority, even in this country, that says, oh, come, don't worry, we're going to look after you. Because, frankly, behind the Iron Curtain, for the best part of 70 years, we're going to look after you meant you weren't coming back home.
Gentlemen, we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining me on Spectator TV, Rod and Trevor there. Let's stick with the vaccine, though, but let's move on to the vaccine diplomacy, because you do need passports to travel, but this is diplomacy, not vaccine passports. The British government can't get its people vaccinated fast enough, and that's true of many of the Western democracies, but China and Russia have been sending millions of doses of their COVID vaccines abroad. It's all about increasing their influence in the post-pandemic world. It's a new great game, which is the topic of our cover story for this week's magazine, written by The Spectator's broadcast editor, host of our Chinese Whispers podcast, Cindy Yu. She joins me now. Cindy, so bottom line, China and Russia, but especially China, using the distribution of its vaccine to developing countries to further its influence on foreign policy.
Yes, it's an obvious thing to try to do when you think about it, because even as early as last year, China and Russia were sending out their PPE donations to other countries when there was a global shortage. China certainly was sending out its own doctors, which obviously at that point had known quite a lot about the virus by March, April kind of time. And now it's vaccines. So this phase is the truly life-saving phase. And what a lot of countries around the world are experiencing is that actually, they might have Pfizer orders or they might have AstraZeneca, Oxford orders, but a lot of these deliveries are not reliable and might not even start until later this year, pushing them into the hands, into the arms of China and Russia, who, at least for China, you know, they're not vaccinating their own people at the breakneck pace I think we could expect China to do, because they're just directing all of their vaccines abroad. So President Xi's vaccination target for late March is only 4% of the population. That's an incredibly slow pace from the country because they see the soft power potential here.
So just to be clear, you could say that soft power for the, let's take China, soft power for the Chinese leadership, which comes from exporting these vaccines, is some ways becoming, is giving greater priority than the regime vaccinating its own people.
Yes, I think so. But you know, the caveat to that is that China has, according to official figures, defeated COVID within its borders. So obviously there was that January outbreak where 22 million people at one point were in lockdown. But since then, that outbreak has been controlled. Daily figures show maybe less than 5 new cases each day. And so most Chinese people don't feel like they need to be vaccinated anytime soon because they don't feel like they're going to come across it when they go about their daily business. So given there's a lack of pressure from underneath, the Chinese Communist Party is finding it easy to make that calculation to export that abroad.
It seemed, reading your cover story this week, that it's almost like a new scramble for Africa in particular. The Chinese and the Russians going into Zimbabwe was one country you mentioned, going into African countries and offering the pandemic in areas where the Chinese in particular already have some influence. I mean, there's been quite a lot of Chinese involvement in Zimbabwe, for example.
Exactly. Countries like Zimbabwe have amazing natural resources, rare earths that are so important to develop high technology components like mobile phones, electric cars, all that sort of stuff that China controls a lot of the world supply of. You know, China's Belt and Road Initiative that has been established in the last 5 or so years is essentially building these infrastructural links along with the diplomatic links in order for China to grow faster and bigger. And of course, some of these recipient countries are also getting a good deal out of it, especially the governments in control of it. So as I say in my piece, that a lot of the strongman leaders of the world gravitate towards Beijing's gifts. You know, you've got President Mnangagwa of Zimbabwe, Mugabe's successor, saying that his country feels greatly honoured by the Chinese donation of vaccinations. You've got President Erdogan taking a picture of him getting jabbed with Sinopharm, one of China's 2 vaccine producers. You've got Duterte, Philippines' very controversial president, who, you know, has literally talked about a violent and fatal war on drugs, squeezing hand sanitizer onto the Beijing emissary in a very attentive way. So all these strongmen love Chinese investment, and vaccinations is the one way to prove that China's friendship is worth a lot.
And I thought that was a fascinating point, that China was using the distribution of the vaccine to kind of help bolster a strong man, and they're all men, of whom China approves. And that even went as far as the leader of Hungary, who approved Sinopharm, one of the 2 major vaccines that China produces.
Yeah, and Viktor Orban is not one of these countries, you know, he doesn't lead one of these countries that doesn't have, you know, options. He's part of the EU scheme. He doesn't think he's going to get enough jabs that way. So that's why he's turned to Sinopharm. He's also turned to Sputnik, Russia's jab. But with Sinopharm, he goes one step further. He says he's going to take the Sinopharm vaccines at 79% efficacy over the Pfizer one at 95% efficacy, because he says the Chinese have known this virus for the longest. I'm not sure that was quite on brand for the Beijing embassy to hear.
I noticed you said one of, I think it's Sinovac, they've been sending out, even though it's only very recently that it actually got final approval, but it didn't stop them exporting it abroad.
No, and it didn't, you know, it didn't seem to matter for the countries that imported Sinovac either. A lot of it was done under emergency vaccination schemes, which China, of course, has been using itself to vaccinate up to 1 million people domestically. But yes, you're right. Sinovac hasn't, until this month, it didn't get regulatory approval within China. Even now, Sinovac and Sinopharm are not being regulated for use in the over 60s within China. That hasn't stopped them before being used in the elderly in places like Indonesia. So, you know, that's an interesting question as to, you know, the different regulatory authorities and their different standards and why the Chinese themselves don't think that their jabs work for the elderly or are safe enough for the elderly just yet. So you've got a situation where Erdogan's been vaccinated, but maybe the 67-year-old President Xi hasn't even been vaccinated yet.
It's interesting, too, when you look to the question of how does the West respond? Because, of course, the democratic pressure in the West is on the governments to vaccinate their own people first before they start sending vaccines abroad. But you give one example of involving the United Kingdom using manufacturing capabilities in India to produce the Oxford jabs for export to poorer countries in the region. And this was one way of which the West was trying to combat some of the vaccine geopolitics of China and Russia. Tell us more about this Indian venture.
Yeah, so this is very interesting. China, for the last two decades, may have been a factory of the world, but India is still the king when it comes to vaccine manufacturing. The Serum Institute of India is the largest vaccine manufacturer in the world in pre-COVID times, and they've signed a deal with a few different vaccine producers, among which is the Oxford AstraZeneca jab. They think that they can produce up to 1 billion of this this year. And so while the UK's diplomatic focus, or while the UK's nominal focus is on the British citizens, the Oxford AstraZeneca jab has been given to the SII in India to be produced en masse, and the Modi government there is distributing them, especially in Asia. So you've got an interesting situation where India and China are fighting over their neighbours like Sri Lanka and Bangladesh. And for those two countries, India has won over, and those two countries have opted for the Oxford jab instead. You've also got an awkward situation where it seems like the Oxford jab might not be universally applicable in the sense that in South Africa, where the new strain has come from, the Oxford jab doesn't seem as effective. So India did export some to that country, but now it doesn't seem to be really working there. Sputnik has applied for approval in South Africa, so you can see that China and Russia are never far behind.
No, indeed. I just finally, Cindy, we've seen the British working in India to do something which is not designed to counter China or Russia, but it could have that effect. Am I right in thinking we haven't heard anything from the Biden administration about this yet?
Yeah, so the Biden administration, on the first day of him coming in, symbolically kind of stopped their departure from the WHO in a sort of, we're not Trump way. And they also joined in COVAX, which is the WHO's developing world vaccine scheme. They threw some money at it, but it's not nearly enough. America has also ordered, like many other high-income countries, many more vaccines than it will ever need, which adds to the pressure, the supply pressures around the world. And America, I think, it's Biden itself, himself, he aims to vaccinate all Americans by July. So the focus is very much like the British focus on the home turf, which has led to long-time America allies like even Mexico to turn to Sputnik for help because they can't get their hands on any Pfizer. So I think the question is this: before Biden came into power, there was all this talk about how Trump was the obstacle to this international alliance against China in particular. Now that Biden is in office, what is he actually doing that's different to unite these Western countries to see off this Chinese challenge? And it doesn't seem like there's much going on there yet at the moment.
No, I thought it was fascinating, Sydney, in your piece, at the way the Russians had got in to provide Mexico with the vaccine, whereas almost nothing, if anything, had come from America. That's changed days indeed. Cindy, thanks for being with us. It's great to hear from you. You can read Cindy's excellent cover piece on the geopolitics of vaccine, the vaccine wars. It's an issue which the Spectator has been ahead of the game on, and Cindy's cover story brings us up to date. You can also hear from Cindy on her podcast. It's available at spectator.co.uk/Chinese Whispers. That's spectator.co.uk/Chinese Whispers. Now, remember, if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel, it's free. You'll never miss another episode. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. And our final segment for today: what makes the English English? In the lead article of The Spectator's arts pages this week, journalist Dan Hitchens writes about the renewed interest in the Anglo-Saxons and the Anglo-Saxon period, thanks to the Netflix film, The Dig, about Sutton Hoo, and a BBC series called The Detectorists. He joins the show now, together with Harry Mount. He's the editor of The Odeon magazine and author of How England Made the English. Dan, let me come to you first. Is it film and TV that accounts for this new interest in the Anglo-Saxon period?
You could go back further. You could say Seamus Heaney, biggest English language poet of the age, translating Beowulf, was what kicked off the interest. But I think in the end, it is film and TV that have really popularized this. The other big event, I suppose, was 2009, when the Staffordshire Hoard was discovered, this amazing biggest haul of Anglo-Saxon gold ever found, which sort of opened a window into another age as well, because Anglo-Saxon kings needed a lot of treasure. It's how you reward your followers. And so they had a vast amount of this very impressive, often breathtakingly beautiful jeweled sword hilts and that sort of thing, all buried in one place. That really caught the public imagination. And I think that's part of what sort of laid the ground for things like The Dig, which is quite a surprising thing to be a big Netflix film. You know, it's not about the Nazis or the Tudors. It's about
Superman.
Or Superman, or a kind of Downton Abbey thing. It's the upper ship burial from the 7th century. And yet people were sort of fascinated about it. There's some idea about a lost world there, which I think really appeals to people.
The one thing that came through from The Dig on Sutton Hoo, and also in the Staffordshire Horde story, is that it seemed to open our eyes a bit. I think I remember a bit in The Dig where one of the archaeologists is pretty sure this is a Viking find. Mm. It's not Anglo-Saxon. Because the Anglo-Saxons weren't that sophisticated. And it turns out that they were, and that seemed to be one of the significant points of both findings. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think I like The Dig less than most people seem to see it. It was a bit clunky, but the nice thing about it being clunky was that you did get lines like, the Dark Ages are no longer dark. So it was this sense that the Anglo-Saxons are being rehabilitated, that, you know, the discovery that they had... particular kind of coinage, I think it was in the film, showed this sophisticated form of government. But you can look further. I mean, the artistic achievements are amazing. The administrative changes brought in by Alfred the Great, which form a lot of our, you know, current system, is sort of derived from that. Harry's written about how, you know, the very place names of the country, you know, most of them were born before that time. So a lot of things take for granted, and a lot of very great artistic, cultural, political achievements date from that time. And there's some consciousness of that that seems to be coming back now.
Harry, what do you think accounts for this renewed interest in the Anglo-Saxon period and that role in our history?
Well, I think The Dig is a big reason, but also it's just a gradual realisation of the way Anglo-Saxon history has been marginalised. I think it's partly because of those two big dates, 410 AD, when the Romans leave Britain, and 1066, the most famous date of all, Battle of Hastings. And people tend to think correctly that a foreign invader left in 410 with the Romans, a foreign invader arrived in 1066 with William the Conqueror, but they wrongly think that in between nothing happened. Well, that's an incredibly long time, 650 years. That's longer than the Romans were here. If you go forward from 1066, that takes you to the 18th century. And as Dan says in his great piece, so much of particularly English history is set in place by the Anglo-Saxons. So there's a monarchy, the church is set up, there's coinage, as Dan said, our county system, Norfolk and Devonshire were there in the 11th century. And most importantly, the language. So the language we're speaking today, when you talk about English, well, two-thirds of the words in the dictionary are from Latin or Greek, but we don't use so many of them. Most of the words we're using today, the three of us talking, are based in Anglo-Saxon. Particularly, we won't be using any swear words, but most of our swear words are Anglo-Saxon.
So, shorter ones, too.
Exactly. So much of what we're doing and saying today is thanks to the Anglo-Saxons, but they were marginalised for a long time in history, and I think we're just gradually revealing how important they were.
Well, the longevity of Anglo-Saxon influence interests me, because in that period from the departure of the Romans and the arrival of William the Conqueror, I mean, they were bashed around a lot not long after they arrived. The Viking raids were endless, and when they finally saw these Viking raids off, and Alfred begins to create more of a state that covers a big chunk of what we now think of England, King Canute arrives and the Danes win and the Danes control it. And then no sooner are the Anglo-Saxons coming to terms with that than the Normans arrive. And that is a very different kind of invasion, because they basically attempted to snuff out the Anglo-Saxon culture with almost a Nazi ferocity. And for 300-400 years, the leaders of our country did not speak English or Anglo-Saxon at all. And yet it still somehow survived. In the end, these Norman kings ended up speaking English. Well, what was in it that kept it going, Harry?
You're right. The English kings after William the Conqueror went on speaking French for 200 or so years. But actually, most people in the country, it's not like suddenly overnight they started speaking French. And I think there was a great continuity. So actually, again, we like to think of 1066 as a big break. But in fact, William the Conqueror was a cousin of Edward the Confessor. Edward the Confessor spent a lot of time in Normandy. And so there's a continuity there in terms of just the blood of monarchs. But even things like churches, as Dan said, most settlements in Britain, certainly in England, were there set up by the Anglo-Saxons. And their place names are very often Anglo-Saxon. So it's not like the Normans turned up and said, right, we're kicking you all out, we're changing your place names, you're changing your language. There was a continuity in something like, say, Westminster Abbey was founded by Edward Confessor in 1065. He built a huge abbey there. That then was largely taken over by William the Conqueror and expanded, although you can still see the Anglo-Saxon roots there. So they took over the government, obviously, but actually underneath there was this strong Anglo-Saxon continuity, which, as I say, we can see in our language and place names.
As you say, the people, as opposed to the elite, kept on speaking the language too. Dan, is there a having perhaps marginalized this period in English history? What were called the Dark Ages, and the Dark Ages are no longer dark. Is there a danger that the pendulum may go the other way? We begin to mythologize this. I read a lot about how the Anglo-Saxon Witans are really the forerunners of our parliament, and that's the start of parliamentary democracy, that there was a Anglo-Saxon individualism and community as well, and all the rest of it, that it made it a kind of magical period. Has the pendulum gone too much the other way?
I think it's a bigger risk of seeing it as a kind of warrior age and emphasizing the sort of bloodthirsty Darwinian struggle, which definitely was there. But then there's another story of incredible sort of creativity, of blending influences, so many influences coming from the continent as well. If you look at how art develops, at how like Christian illuminated manuscripts are picking up on non-Christian trends in art. There's just amazing examples of intellectual achievements as well. And I think it's that side of seeing how much was done that that could be emphasized, even if it's not kind of a perfect model of a peaceful state, or however people want to identify it.
Well, I think you brought out an important point, of course, that the Anglo-Saxons, which have often been misused as a kind of racial purity, were actually rather diverse, because they were English, they were Danes, they were Brits, they were the Viking raids, and no doubt others that I've missed out. But Harry, is this renewed interest in Anglo-Saxon roots, renewed interest in what happened in our history before the Normans and how it survived the Normans? Has Brexit done something to bring this on as well? Is this a re-examination of our national identity?
I think less so Brexit, but certainly Scottish independence and the possibility of Welsh independence as well, that is extraordinary. If you look at a map of the development of Anglo-Saxon England, as Dan referred to in his article, England is warring with its different factions through the Anglo-Saxon period. And by the time you get to the 11th century, England is largely unified. And they're beginning to refer to themselves as the Anglii, the Angles. But if you look at those maps, the borders of Wales and Scotland are not identical, but they're pretty much the same today as then. We are not yet having battles between Wessex and Mercia here, are we? And I think that's unlikely to happen. But I think the unified England really was in place by the 10th or 11th century. Those problems we're dealing with now, with a possible Scottish independence, and less likely a Welsh independence, go back to England really being set in stone by the Anglo-Saxons.
And Dan, that, just to finish up with you, that was one thing that did make England different, or what became England at that time. It was an island race, so that makes a difference, though the fact it was an island also meant it was easy to attack from the sea, as the Vikings quickly discovered, and so did others. But also the growth of an Anglo-Saxon community, or covering most of England, even up to Northumbria, which for many years had been given to the Scots or taken by them, that meant that you didn't have the kind of internal battles, civil wars in these days that you had in France or Italy or even in Spain and Germany. That marked England out as different, didn't it?
Right. There's an amazingly continuous story of kind of internal peace. And one thing in the article, so I spoke to Tom Holland, the historian who's written obviously about Anglo-Saxon England as well as everything else. And he sees it as a hopeful story in certain ways, that you get a kind of common purpose emerging among kingdoms which could have been at each other's throats and had been for parts of their history. So he, as a unionist, sees this maybe not as an exact model, but as a sign that you can get very different identities, very different histories actually coming together and agree to live together well.
All right, Dan, we'll leave it there. And Harry, excellent article. Thank you for that. You can read it in the Spectator this week. It's the lead to our arts pages. Harry's book is How England Made the English. It's an excellent read as well. Harry, thank you for joining.
Thank you.
I hope all going well at the OD too. It's good to have you here on Spectator TV.
Pleasure to be here.
And if you're interested, in addition to Harry's book and, of course, Dan's article, Robert Toombs' History of the English or History of England, the earlier part of that goes through the Anglo-Saxon period. And it's a pretty good place to start. It's a broad view, but it's a pretty good place to start if you want to learn a bit about it and then to learn more after that. That's Robert Toombs, the Cambridge historian. That's it for this week. Thanks to all of our guests. And once again, to our very special sponsor, Charles Stanley, for sponsoring The Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms. It's one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. As always, let us have your thoughts on how we're doing, what we're not doing, what we should be doing, to Spectator TV at spectator.co.uk. Join us again next week. Bye-bye.